Hi, and welcome to How to Build a Growth System. So if you've been listening for a while, you'll know that this podcast used to have a different name. The Growth System, as we used to be called, was always about enabling you to take action to solve some of the most intractable challenges in B2B growth. So now, essentially, we're making it easier for you. We're putting everything under one roof. Our conversations like this one, our playbooks, our workshops, essentially all of those great assets that help you to apply what you learn to building your own growth systems. That said, we are in some ways returning to our roots this season as we go back to delving into those endemic negative patterns that hold back B2B growth. And as always, we'll be challenging deeply held assumptions, we'll be using systems thinking to navigate the sheer complexity of it all, and of course, we'll have plenty of practical advice on how to move forward with confidence. So today, we're going to look at the system superpower that is self-organization. And as the season progresses, we'll find out things like what it means when silos keep showing up, no matter how many alignment meetings you run. There you go, Chris. The first time I've said alignment this season. Let's see.
I've stamped it on my bingo card. Yeah.
And how things like how dashboards can sometimes drive dysfunction and other sort of counterintuitive takes. We'll also talk about how to spot hidden growth debt before it costs you, and how to build the kind of self-sustaining system that doesn't rely on heroics every quarter, and lots more this season. Our goal is really to give you clear ideas and tools you can use to design growth that's predictable, scalable, and hopefully just a little bit less stressful. So as always, I'm Colin Shakespeare, and I'm joined by the founder of RevSpace, Chris Bayliss. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Colin.
So I've been reading your article, Chris, on your Medium article on self-organization, the system superpower that will accelerate growth. And I like how you've come right off the bat there by challenging a sort of deeply held assumption, probably so deeply held, actually, that it's really questioned. I think most leaders tend to think that more control means less risk. But I think in reality, as we'll see, and as people will read as they go through the Medium article, more control actually can have hidden costs like slowness, disengagement, fragility. And I think contrary to, I guess, perception, self-organizing teams don't need to be chaotic. They can, in fact, be, as you say, the system superpower that makes growth actually sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that why this was really interesting to write about, and actually why I've been, you know, trying to do a little bit more writing while we've been off air and building out our Medium, which I think if you search RevSpace or medium.com/rev-space, you'll go find that and lots more, is that for us, you know, lots of people talk about growth and they say some really, really fantastic things about, you know, topics on the tactics, you know, the how to do things. But as we always go to on this podcast, it's actually, well, what is, you know, in that sort of midnight zone behind things, what are the deep structuring principles that are really driving performance or indeed not driving performance? And a data point that really stopped me in my tracks was actually a Deloitte study I was reading that made me kind of think about all of this, which was that 79% of leaders globally say that agility is critical, but only 17% believe that they're actually agile. And for me, that sort of, it was just a staggering gap between what leaders say they want and what their systems actually allow them to deliver. And I thought that, well, let's dig into what's behind that gap. And for me, there inevitably, as with anything in systems, there will be a whole bunch of interconnected stuff there. But the thing that really struck me was this kind of concept, as you said in the intro, of control, that we have this kind of control as a reflex, almost control as a mechanism for management. You know, we've could have been taught that over time, the way that you effectively manage things is you control them, you tightly grip them. And as on this podcast, we always talk about growth teams. I think that, you know, whilst that stat in the Deloitte study was about organizations in general, you know, when you really look at that in the context of the growth team, it's one of the least effective mechanisms for driving performance within growth teams that you can imagine, because you know, work in growth is exploratory by nature. It's fast changing. It's nonlinear. It's kind of data driven. And rigidity, you know, standardization, approval chains, you know, control mechanisms in general, they create fragility. They slow down adaptation. They slow down experimentation. You know, they suppress feedback. And ultimately, they create a sort of risk-averse culture that stops growth teams performing at their best. So we're going to kind of hopefully explore today, well, what do you do instead of control and still do things in such a way as that you can do things with confidence?
Yeah, so there's this massive gap, I think it probably in all areas of life, there's this massive gap between what we say we want and what we actually build. There's this sort of addiction to control. That's what it looks like. But then I guess the people that we're talking about, growth leaders, you know, they're, I mean, if you think about just people that you know in that position, these are some of the most brilliant people you know, right? And they're responding to real pressures, board expectations, quality control, risk. And of course, there is this reflex to apply control at these sort of stressful moments. So how do we, obviously governance is still going to be important. So how do we separate smart governance from, a kind of control theater, if you like?
And it's a great question. And ultimately, it's a difficult question to answer, but we're going to do our best, because intrinsically, control isn't bad. It's just overused in modern management, if indeed we can call it that, because I think modern management actually is really legacy management. You know, we have this kind of cultural expectation and ideals that have been developed since kind of, you know, time and motion studies 100 years ago. And yeah, that was kind of the foundation of modern management, I guess. But what it's created is this kind of, from a systems thinking perspective, this sort of reinforcing loop gone wrong. And it starts, absolutely, it's founded in good intent. It's founded in the desire for quality and accountability. But the thing with reinforcing loops is that they spiral, that they have unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences are what we see around us every day in most modern organizations, supposedly modern organizations. And that's that whenever we have a problem, the reaction is to tighten control, it's to have more compliance, more predictability, that to improve performance, we've somehow got to introduce more rules, you know, more KPIs, more oversight mechanisms to ensure that we get where we want to go. And that sort of sounds logical in a boardroom as a reaction. But in reality, what happens is that, you know, when you add control, you ultimately create temporary compliance, but you typically also create a whole bunch of friction. And friction creates new failures. It creates, you know, a reduction in performance rather than an increase in performance, because we're going slower. You know, we're ultimately losing adaptability. And adaptability, particularly in growth teams, is absolutely critical, because, you know, what are growth teams if not the mechanism for responding to the market and for interpreting the market and bringing that interpretation back into the business? So for me, you know, control mechanisms are often detached from the sort of local context in which they exist. And when you create that sort of control structure, what you're really creating is a bottleneck. And it means that you're not able to keep up with the sort of real-time needs of the business and the real-time requirements of the market, and a whole bunch of other stuff happens at the same time. You know, that is probably the visible manifestation of too much control, but actually a whole bunch of other stuff happens in the background, like suppression of feedback.
That's what I was thinking as well. It starts to become a sort of psychological safety issue, even, where sort of over controlling environments are sort of discouraging people from surfacing issues or experimenting, and there's a sort of blocking of weak signals that could actually prevent failure and ultimately leading to bigger failures down the line. And I think that actually really resonates with me as someone who sort of studies history of you know, dictatorships and things like that, where there's a really extreme examples of sort of centralized sort of too much control, essentially, and then ultimately we can lead to to system collapse in some cases, because there is this, as you say, suppression of feedback.
Absolutely. And you know, when we don't listen to those quiet signals, because we have no incentive to listen to it, because the more control there is, the more we abdicate responsibility for control to the system itself or to the management structure that's created it. So, you know, we don't hear those things and we don't kind of prevent failure by, because we don't listen to those quiet signs that it's happening slowly. And I think this is really related to another thing, which I think is absolutely critical, which is too much control erodes ownership and kind of the intrinsic motivation to be responsible for the result. You know, if we're saying you must do this in this way, you know, you must hit these KPIs for this reason by doing this thing, by following this process, then the job actually becomes disassociated from the result. You know, the team member's job is to follow the process. And if the process doesn't deliver, well, that wasn't their problem because it wasn't their process. And that, I think, is really the nucleus of the idea that self-control is the sort of self-organization is the response that is required to this scenario. So, you know, let's maybe kind of dive in and talk about how we get there, because when you view things through this kind of system lens, then this sort of misguided reinforcing loop of control, you can see this in the data in terms of what happens here. I mean, we're talking about this, and I think hopefully everyone that listens to this podcast will be instinctively thinking, yeah, absolutely, I recognize that. But there are some studies out there. You know, McKinsey found that organizations with high internal bureaucracy score 20% lower on innovation metrics. Now, I didn't dive too much into that study, I must say. I'm not sure what McKinsey's innovation metrics particularly mean, but I think that, you know, we can see that there is certainly a correlation between bureaucracy and innovation. It's kind of natural.
Again, not just in growth teams or in business, but in sort of any organization, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the more you know, tighten the lid down, the less freedom there is for you know, experimentation, and experimentation is where great stuff comes from very often. And I think that really relates to empowerment, doesn't it? And there was a study by Gallup that suggested that only a third of employees feel empowered to make decisions about their own work. And this was a management study, so you know, we're not talking about, you know, a manufacturing organization, something there. I mean, it is endemic.
So I was just imagining working on the production line in a factory, as I have done in my youth, and starting to like feel innovative and wanting to make decisions about how I operate the 250-ton press or whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe in some circumstances, innovation would be bad, and actually just repeating the same process would be great. But in our world, as you sort of eloquently outlined earlier, essentially being able to make decisions about your own work, innovate and adapt on the hop on a daily basis is as important as anything that we do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that factory, yeah, narrative, analogy, story is, you know, and I've done the same thing. You know, when I started working on the graduate scheme many, many years ago at Jaguar Land Rover, I spent 2 weeks in a factory riveting parts of XJs together. So apologies to anyone that's bought on where the, you know, rear wing has fallen off, because that's probably my fault. But you know, if you innovate and decide where the rivets are just going to go somewhere else, you know, that's not really ever going to end to a good outcome. But it's that same management structure, that same kind of, you know, ideology, methodology, call it what you will, that's permeated, you know, services-based organizations, that's permeated, you know, modern organizations that don't rivet stuff. They are knowledge workers, as we probably used to call them, and the same rules don't apply. And yet we try to impose those same rules into that very different scenario. So, you know, why does it persist? Well, it's probably because control feels safe. You know, it signals certainty to your board or the regulators or the investors or whoever it is that's, you know, got the control on the management team right at the top, because it creates a sort of false sense of risk mitigation, I guess. And in reality, it does nothing of the sort, because it creates entirely new risks through this kind of reinforcing feedback loop we talked about a second ago.
Yeah, indeed. So it strikes me that a lot of this has got to do with setting in place the right sort of deep structure in the first place. Like, we talked a lot last season about some of these principles, and in particular, purpose, I think, is relevant here. As long as everyone is sort of pulling towards the same well-defined North Star, i.e. the purpose, then we should be able to do this, essentially. But I think one of the problems we have is that most leaders think that they have a clear purpose. They've got mission statements, they've got OKRs, they've got targets. Why isn't that enough?
It's a great question. And I think it's not really the point is, yeah, not whether it's enough. It's a point about how it's deployed and the conditions in which that sort of deployment has taken place, if you will. And for me, I really like the analogy of like a bowling alley when we're talking about this. Bear with me here. I know it sounds slightly weird, but when you have a bowling alley, you know, you've got a very, very clear purpose. You know, you've got to knock 10 pins down and you've got to roll the ball down there. And I think it's a great metaphor for business because whatever the purpose in our organization is, make money, you know, save the world, promote, you know, a tourist kind of location, whatever it might be, you know, we've already got this kind of stated purpose. And sometimes that's not very clear, but you know, that's part of the problem. But I think you can really think about that purpose like the pins at the end of the bowling lane. And what we've got, certainly, if you bowl like I do, is bumpers on the side of the lane. And yeah, you know, these are the constraints that we impose as the organization. These are the control mechanisms to keep the ball going down in the right direction. And what we tend to see is that this sort of governance, compliance, you know, you might loosely call it strategy, is to pull the bumpers right in. So there's very, very little space for the ball to deviate from its course. And that, much like in bowling, you know, it means that you probably are not going to get the result that you expected. You know, you're not going to be able to shape the ball. You're not going to be able to, tackle the pins from a different direction. You know, if they all fall over on the first pass, great. But what if they don't? You know, then all you're going to do is send the ball straight through the gap that you already created. You know, you're not going to be able to go and widen your strategic horizons and hit other things. So most execs, I think, they can articulate the pins. You know, they can talk about the vision. They probably do have OKRs as a team. They've got financial goals, but they rarely invest in thinking about how well aligned those are at a team level. And ultimately, they feel like keeping them as tight as possible, keeping them as unambiguous as possible with as little room for maneuver as possible is the best way to get the result. And if you don't give people permission to go and experiment in their roles, then ultimately what you're doing is ensuring that every decision moves upwards, not outwards. You know, it has to. When you create those conditions. So what we'll explore, I guess, in a second is, okay, well, what conditions do you need to create to move the bumpers backwards? Because clearly you can't just take all of the you know, the bumpers away. You can't take all of that the control architecture away from the organization and expect the ball to not fall into the gutter. There's got to be something in a certain place. And so the role of the manager is working out where to set that. And I think when you look at organizations that do that well, you see that can be a huge enabler to growth.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we're thinking about this in quite a sort of structural and theoretical way. For the listeners who this no doubt resonates with, let's think about what it looks like in reality. So on Monday morning, let's say we decide, okay, I'm going to loosen control. What happens? We're recording this on a Friday. What happens on Monday morning when you step in?
Well, you know, it's easy to just skip in an explanation right to the end. I mean, I think Amazon are obviously often lauded as someone that does this quite well because they have this kind of, and I think Meta and other people do this as well, like they have this kind of aligned autonomy, aligned freedom maybe, that that enables them to kind of rapidly deploy different versions of software. So I think Amazon have this like two pizza teams thing that they that people often write about, which is, I think, you know, any team that's bigger than can be fed by two pizzas is too big. It creates too much structure. It creates too much bureaucracy. And Amazon deploy software every something like 12 seconds, I think. And it's because they have in their software teams, you know, clear APIs, clear permissions, clear goals, clear accountability, but they're not actually told what they're going to deploy, just how, what they're supposed to, you know, what the goal is. And they deploy lots and lots of structured tests and they let the data decide, but they give the teams the ability to kind of solve problems. And ultimately that's where you want to get to, is the ability for your team to think for themselves, to solve problems for themselves, but do so within the confines. So coming back to kind of, well, what do you do on Monday morning? Well, I think it depends on the conditions that you've created as a manager. And if you haven't created the conditions for self-organization, for loosening control, then actually what you've got to do is start there. And the conditions, to my mind, well, there's three, arguably four, that you've really got to think about. And the first and foremost, to my mind, one is about creating clarity. It's all about defining the pins at the end of the bowling lane. And so often we think that we've done that well because the business has a objective, like we're going to, you know, be at 26 million by the end of 2026, or they have some financial target that's supposed to be some sort of overarching motivator for the entire organization. And revenue is always a bad purpose, in my opinion, because it doesn't help people shape what they actually do. So in last season, we talked about purpose, as you kind of already mentioned, and we talked about purpose being fractal. You know, how do we kind of create clarity by making sure that the purpose is really applied to the team that is being managed? So as a manager, you know, your role is really to create clarity for your team about what their bowling pins look like that's going to be well aligned to the overall, you know, purpose of the organization. So make sure everyone knows where they're throwing the ball. You know, create the clarity is definitely role one. The other thing that I think is really there for the kind of the manager, for the leader to do, is also to ensure that they're kind of creating and increasing the capability to actually get the ball down the lane. Which can be technical skills, you know, it's you know, we got a better technique for throwing it, but actually it can really be about interpersonal skills, collaboration skills, you know, our ability to kind of work cross-functionally. You know, those skills, those kind of what perhaps would have, in old-fashioned terms, would have been called soft skills, you know, they're really important to driving collaboration, because it really allows the team to be a system. You know, a system is more than the sum of its parts. It's more than just the individual. But it also comes down to like hiring strategy and budgets and stuff like that. So how are we putting the right people in place? Are we equipping them in the right way to achieve the goal that we've created with the clarity? And also it's about, you know, the system itself. Of course, it's about the system. It's, you know, it's how to build a growth system. And actually the kind of workflows and processes they follow, but something you said earlier, which is so, so important, you know, psychological safety is part of the system. You know, do we actually give them the permission to get it wrong? You know, because if we say, oh, yeah, great, you know, go make your own decisions, but then, you know, you fire the first person that gets something wrong. Well, funny enough, you're not creating the conditions there for people to actually thrive and get stuff right. And I think that that's why I say, yeah, there's three, maybe four options here, because I think that an under-talked about one in the sort of field of self-organization or self-organizing teams is actually about belief. You know, it's the fact that the person you're managing, it's you as the manager believing that the person that you're managing has the inherent tools in themselves, the inherent skills and capability to actually solve problems for themselves. So you don't have to be the hero manager. You know, you don't have to be the one that rides in on a white charger and solves everyone's problems. And actually that you start to adapt your role as the leader within that organization or that business unit or that team to be a coach rather than a directive leader, to actually ask them the questions of, you know, who do you think you could talk to? You know, who could be an ally in solving this problem? What tools might you need? And just to really ask those open-ended questions that get someone to the point of realizing that they do have that internal capability. And then that belief isn't just in you as the leader in that team, but also it's creating the belief within the team itself that they can solve those problems.
Yeah, it needs to be reciprocal, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. It does need to be reciprocal, because the management style of control that we've talked about, you know, has been the default position for most organizations for a century. You know, you can't just come in on Monday morning and say, you know, it's a free for all, you know, bowling pins are over there, let me know when you're done. Because, do you know, I think that actually in most organizations, it wouldn't become chaos. Just nothing would change. In fact, actually, probably it'd be worse, because people would be like, oh, yeah, but you don't mean that, do you? And I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing, because I've never had to make that decision before. And, you know, you would get a sort of, you know, William Golding scenario, I think, where you'd have certain people that would come to the fore, and actually you would have a breakdown in team cohesion. You would, you know, the chaos would be creeping, not immediate. And I think that therefore, you know, this sort of self-organization is still about creating the conditions. It's about putting the bumpers in the right place, and it's about all kind of putting those things in place to make that really happen. And if you haven't invested in the system itself, and you haven't changed the way in which you're managing, you haven't created the clarity, then you're never going to get the outcome you want from putting more freedom into the team to make decisions.
So just going back to your Medium article, just for a sec, you, and apologies to any Dutch friends and listeners for murdering the pronunciation, but the Burtzorg story was particularly interesting to me, particularly on a personal level. So the negative example of self-organizing teams actually being a chaotic disaster that I have seen in my life was with a social care company, where really none of what we've just been talking about was put in place. However, the initiative was, we are essentially going to get rid of middle management, and everyone's going to become a part of a self-organizing team, which it's almost as if the executives at the social care company had been to a presentation about the Burtzorg story, which is also a healthcare company, and then thought, oh, we can do that, but without actually learning the sort of devilish detail of what it is that they needed to do. And it was a complete disaster. And of course, the reflex was to then try and rehire all that management capability, which obviously is very difficult to do. It's hard to rebuild capabilities that you've cut, and of course you're getting outside hires into the organization, and generally it was a disaster. But the reflex was then to impose more control, because, oh my god, we've seen the harsh reality of self-organizing teams, and we definitely don't want that here. Then I actually read the Burtzorg story, having read your Medium article, and I think that really kind of flipped my mind around about where this could work. It seems to challenge everything I think we know about management.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your example, your sort of unfortunately lived example there is a really interesting one, because it comes in itself down to purpose, because I suspect the purpose of the management team was not to create a self-organizing utopia to improve performance. It was actually to cut a couple hundred grand out of the the wages bill for the middle management people that they didn't think were doing a lot. And that's a really, really important distinction. You know, as you said, it's ensuring that you've created the conditions. But yeah, Burtzorg seemed to do this really, really well. And I think that's why I put that kind of example in the article, because you wouldn't think that healthcare would be a natural starting point, would be a natural kind of a sort of industry where this would work really well. You know, if we were using an example, said, oh yes, some little Silicon Valley startup decided they weren't going to have any middle management and everyone made their own decisions, you'd go, oh great, yeah, but whatever. You know, Burtzorg were a Dutch community healthcare company, and healthcare, as everyone knows, is high risk, high stakes, tightly regulated, hugely outcomes driven. And they decided that they were going to eliminate traditional management. And they created small autonomous nursing teams, so like 10, 12 people, and they managed everything. Schedules, budgets, care plans, and no conventional top-down review structure, no conventional boss in inverted commas checking that everyone had done their job. And you would think that that would be maybe not chaos, but certainly that it would be hugely variable based on, you know, who you had in those teams. But for them, it worked phenomenally well. In fact, patient satisfaction scores soared to like 9 and a bit out of 10. They had a 30% reduction in admin overhead and much higher nurse retention, much higher job satisfaction. But the question is, okay, well, why did that work? You know, we've just talked about the conditions, and the ones that really stood out to me were that they started with purpose. So they made it abundantly clear at the start through ensuring that everyone understood what their role was in this, that the purpose of Birdsorg was about care quality. It was about dignity, and it was about community interest and community benefit. That their guiding light, their North Star, was to ensure that the care was incredible, that the patients were treated with dignity, and that they had a positive impact on their communities. And that really created the conditions in terms of governing the way that the small decisions were made every day. And some of the bigger decisions were then enabled by working on the system. So they created actually a whole new IT platform, which can be fraught with its own challenges, but we'll sort of gloss over that one. And because what it did is, rather than giving them an archaic, you know, legacy healthcare system, they gave teams real-time patient data, they gave them scheduling tools, they gave them KPI tracking, you know, they gave them essentially all of the things they needed to make those day-to-day decisions and to create those care plans, and to kind of, and they sort of baked the governance into the system. But they enabled them not to, as traditional kind of home healthcare organizations would, to just push out, here's your care plan for the week. You know, you will be going from house A to house B to house C, and you've got, you know, 20-minute cycle per whatever, and we expect you to get to, you know, 200 houses today within your, you know, healthcare team. And they just said, well, here's everything that's got to be done this week. You know, here's our contractual requirements. You know, here's our patient roster. Go plan. And it gave them the freedom within the system to plan, to schedule, to design the care plan that was going to be right for the individual, because it was linked to this kind of commitment to purpose of sort of quality care and dignity and community. And it just created this incredible result, as I say, this huge kind of soar within patient satisfaction and, you know, team satisfaction, and it reduced cost. So it was just a sort of perfect, you know, perfect combination.
So I guess this is time to sort of challenge the listeners and say, like, if a healthcare company can do this at sort of self-organization at scale, like at a national level with such success, like ticking every box of success, why not your SaaS or sort of technical services team? Like, why not your go-to-market team? Why not your product org? And I guess that for the last few minutes, that kind of brings us round to thinking, well, okay, this is all beautiful, but how do you sell this idea when very powerful stakeholders, investors, for example, expect metrics and control? Like, let's say someone's listening between meetings right now, although I don't know many executives who have sort of 40 minutes between their meetings, but like, but let's assume that that's a thing. Maybe they're commuting. What is one thing they can actually try this week to start?
Well, I mean, the one thing, maybe it's 3.5 things, is to start creating the conditions, because even if you don't move the bumpers out for a while, getting clear on purpose, you know, getting clarity into the team on what they're supposed to be achieving, starting to build the systems that enable you to do that, you know, starting to work out how you develop your team, you know, how you bring the right people in, you know, that will be additive to performance in any set of conditions. You know, if people, you have smarter, better people, and they're more clear on what they need to do, and you start to collaborate with them on building systems, and this is something actually I didn't mention earlier, but is really key, you know, system design, and this is what, you know, this is our day-to-day, is not about top-down. It's not about, you know, landing a spaceship with a new process on, and it's just come down from above, and then it's going to be imposed on everyone. It's about co-creating, it's about collaborating, it's about workshopping it out, it's about, you know, getting onto the ground and starting to work out where is the friction, you know, where is it hurting, where is it slowing us down, because that will really start to give you the diagnostic data to understand how you start adapting the system. So, you know, we've got the right people and we've got the right purpose and we've got the right clarity on what that purpose is, then really the movement towards the bumpers edging back on the bowling lane is that we've got to then start doing the system design work to really design that tactical autonomy in for the team to enable them to begin self-organizing. And the thing I think that you can really start to do here is to experiment with that, is to prove that it works to the business, because, you know, our investors, our board, you know, they've all been brought up in this illusion of control, you know, culture that means that, you know, more is better. And if we had a project, you know, we have a sort of a cross-functional team, we have a sort of experimental project, we have a sort of, I don't know what, but something that is somewhat self-contained, you know, that's a great way to experiment with a new management structure, a new style of getting work done, and to use that as the case study, you know, to use that as the beachhead for starting to explain how this could work internally. And it also means that when we start small, we're starting in a way that is reasonably risk-free. You know, I've always really liked the sort of, 70-20-10 model of innovation. And this could be a 10% activity. This could be something where it might fail. It's okay for it to fail. You know, it probably won't if you do it right. But, you know, let's build that as the psychological safety barrier around this little project, this experiment, that if it all goes wrong, who cares? You know, we've risked a small amount in pursuit of a big gain. And it probably won't, because you'll create those conditions, you'll create that psychological safety for people to start making the decisions. And if you've got clarity of purpose and you put the right people in place, you know, we've invested in the capability, and then we've started to build that system around them that's going to enable them to succeed. Do you know what? They probably will.
And obviously there will be mistakes there, but you need, I guess there's a mindset shift there. The mistakes are gold. This is the data for system improvement, not evidence of failure. I think one thing that's become clear throughout this is the key is how you respond to this. So if you punish the team for mistakes, then there's a good chance the system will snap back to these old habits, and sometimes with a real knee-jerk, so that it essentially you end up with even more centralized control than you had. But as you were saying, there needs to be a mindset shift in management to more of a coaching mindset, coach through the mistakes, build capacity. I think just to go back to a third mention of psychological safety here, that's essentially the secret ingredient and allows us to sort of take risks here without fear. And that really fuels the adaptability that we need and that we're trying to foster here, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, this isn't about doing less as a leader. It's about reframing your role as a leader. It's about doing things differently. Because ultimately, you can't scale a business and keep scaling a business by making every single decision yourself. You scale it by creating and designing in the conditions under which smart decisions can happen without you. And that's really the key thing. I mean, there was I think Richard Branson isn't, for UK listeners, they'll probably know the name, the founder of Virgin Records and Virgin Atlantic and the Virgin Group, and I think probably some traction with our US listeners there, but I don't think he's necessarily held up as being quite the business guru that perhaps he once was in the early 2000s. But in his book, there was one thing that really stood out to me, and it's been something that I've actually kind of been guided by, is that if you hire smart people and stay out of their way, good things will happen. You know, that was the quote from his book. And I think that whilst he wasn't specifically talking about self-organization there, in reality, that was him creating the conditions for self-organization to take place. So don't do less, do different, put the right people in place, get them pointing in the right direction, you know, take a step back, enable them with the right system, and good things will happen. And if we can go and do that, or do a bit of that, or experiment with that, then, yeah, that's my kind of challenge, I guess, to the listeners, is pick somewhere where control is slowing stuff down and, you know, do a bit of put the right people in place and step out of the way and see what happens.
Yeah, great. Sadly, that, Chris, that's just about all we have got time for. I think this is a topic, like, as always, that we could probably talk and talk about. I just wanted to finish with an uncomfortable thought for the listeners to leave with.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Your best people are already self-organizing. You know it's true. And the question is, are you fighting it or are you enabling it? So there you go. Take that away and stress about it at night. But yeah, I'd really like to hear from anyone who sort of actually kind of takes your prompt there and sort of picks one process that they over control and finds out what actually happens if you replace an approval step with a coaching conversation, for example. Love to hear the feedback. But that really is all we've got time for this week for the first episode of How to Build a Growth System. So How to Build a Growth System is brought to you, as always, by RevSpace, a growth system consultancy, a growth systems consultancy that connects B2B organizations with a future of growth, offering account-based growth managed services and go-to-market engineering projects. Please don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. It really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience. And we'd really appreciate a moment of your time to tell us what you think. And actually, that feedback has really helped to kind of reshape what we're doing here.
Yeah, so thanks to everyone for listening. Colin's off to practice his outro, and we'll be back next week with more systems goodness.
Yeah, it'll take a few runs through, I think. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.